everybody. Welcome to Theater Schmooze from Alliance for Jewish Theater, where we chat with Jewish theater makers from around the world about their art, Judaism, and vision for theater's future. I'm your host, Danielle Levski. Today, we'll be talking with Kimberly Senior, who is a director based in Springfield, New Jersey. It's such an honor to have you on our show, Kimberly.
Thank you, Danielle. I'm so happy to be here and so glad you're doing this.
Yeah, I'm really glad we got this started. Our first guest was Emily Mann, and I just feel like we're on a really awesome trajectory of guests. So really happy to have you as guest number two.
Oh, well, thank you. Those are some big shoes to fill. Emily is definitely a mentor in my life, so that's great.
Oh, yeah. Really?
Yeah.
We got to play a game of Jewish geography at some point, though. Yeah. In fact, I want to go on a little journey back in time to your speech from Alliance for Jewish Theater's 2016 conference, where you were sharing your experiences directing a production of Wendy Kesselman's The Diary of Anne Frank and the casting choices you made for it. You brought up a question of nomenclature, how theater artists self-identify, and you very aptly stated that naming things gives it an identity. So what does that mean to you personally, as a director of many different identities?
That's a really big question. And I also think that like we continue to evolve in what that means. I think that in names, there's great power and in a positive way, like to really claim and own something. And I also think when we name things, we put them into a box and that is the only place that they can live. So, right, we're constantly talking about walking the line of those two things. And so I feel like when we're speaking about, I actually am going to give an example from another play, which is a play called Sheltered by Alex Sobler. Alex is also another wonderful Jewish theater maker. And we did this play at the Alliance Theater in 2018. We did that play. And that play is about two American Jews who are able to, in 1939, before everything fell apart, were able to rescue some Jewish children from Austria. And the complications of removing children from their parents and kind of all the ethical dilemma. And it's a really quite beautiful play. And we were casting that play and this woman came into audition and she was fantastic, who I happened to like know her. And I also knew that she was not Jewish. And there was this whole debate about what does that mean? Like, can she play this character? And I spoke to a mutual friend of mine who played Asher Lev in my production of My Name is Asher Lev. And I was like, what do I do? What do I do? And he said, Kimberly, I want to quote the rabbi that when we went to Shabbat at this Chabad when we were making Asher Lev, and the rabbi did this, his huge like kind of sermon of the night was about how the Jewish life is full of passion. And then he said, well, is this actress, is she full of passion? I said, yes, she is. He said, well, you have your answer. The Jewish life is full of passion. And so, you know, we talk so much about representation, but like the sense of what Jews look like on the outside is very far ranging. As we know, there are Jews of all colors, of all shapes and size from all over the world. And so we can't necessarily say that someone looks Jewish to play a part. So that was not a thing. And when we're talking about what the core or kernel of that character required was something that she embodied. And so therefore, like that made sense to me. And then you ask me about Disgraced, which is very much about our external identity and how other people name us and how other people perceive us. And so in that case, it would, in a story that is about identity, about the way you look, about how the world names you versus how you name yourself, that becomes a very different story. There we're seeing the power of naming in the negative way, right? Like, I name you this, therefore you are that. As opposed to, I think also what we're seeing now so much in our culture, and I've definitely felt it in my career, as a woman and also as a Jew, that like those were not words that I always used to describe myself. And now I will not describe myself any other way, right? Like that those are things that are very important to me now. I directed a production of The Whipping Man by Matthew Lopez. Matthew wrote a beautiful play that takes place in April of 1865 at the end of the Civil War. And it is a play that has three characters in it, a young Jewish soldier and two slaves that are emancipated over the course of the play due to the events, world events, but they have been quote unquote raised Jewish in this home. So they are Black, they are slaves, and they are Jewish. And it is also, if you want to check your history, it's Passover. So there's a Seder that happens over the course of the play. None of my actors were actually Jewish. And, you know, when I talked through the Seder, and my rabbi from Beth Emmet in Evanston, she came in and she spoke with us, Rabbi Andrea London. She was fantastic. And we had a Seder, which was so amazing and special. And after one of the preview performances, a woman from the audience in Skokie at North Light Theater, which is a predominantly Jewish area and a predominantly Jewish audience, came up to me and said, excuse me, you might want to have a Jewish consultant come in and talk to you because you're mispronouncing some of the prayers. And I had to correct her, you know, just because my name isn't Schwartz, that I actually am Jewish, and that my rabbi had come in, you know, and that's sort of one of the marvelous things about Judaism is that we are a very multifaceted and diverse culture inside of this religion. And it was just an interesting moment. You know, and the other casting moment I wanted to talk about was about Anne Frank. So I did The Diary of Anne Frank at Writers Theater in Glencoe. And the only person I cast who was actually Jewish was the woman who played Meep, who is one of the only non-Jewish characters in the play. It just worked out that way. And when someone spoke to me about it, I said, well, like, do we hire serial killers to play serial killers? Like, you don't have to. That's what acting is, right? Is about like embodying an experience other than your own. And there's a contract with the audience that we know we're actors. They're not the real thing. It's not a documentary. And that furthermore, even if everybody had been Jewish in that cast, none of them would have survived the Holocaust. I mean, the whole cast was like under the age of 40. It's like I don't know what that experience is like. That's not my experience. And so we need to be able to, as storytellers, and again, this is another place of really careful division, right? Like, how much of your own lived experience are you bringing, and how much of it is the job of the storyteller to, whether through actual like hardcore research and our amazing tools of empathy and imagination, like bring this character to life, like where does that line cross? And I think it's a conversation that has no answer and that is really like bubbly and lively in the American theater right now about who has the right to tell what story, who has the right to represent what character. I do hope we move to a place of curiosity. I talk a lot about curiosity now and how when I work with people who are different than me, whether by gender or age or geography or race or religion or whatever it is, I ask more questions because I won't make assumptions about their experience. And I find sometimes when I'm have a shorthand with people simply because of like, oh, you went to that summer camp. Well, so did I. Well, now I assume I know things about you that we're often incorrect and we're skipping steps, and that there's a wonderful curiosity that we are afforded as storytellers to ask questions of fellow artists that I think makes the work richer and more exciting. And I hope that there's a way that we can do that while still honoring and centering stories that need to be heard that have perhaps been marginalized, right? It doesn't just want to be a majority lens that like shoves those stories into focus. But right, I want to be able to like help amplify those voices, and that hopefully we'll move to a place eventually where we're all telling everybody's stories.
Yeah.
In my fantasy of the world.
You know, it's a fantasy I wholeheartedly agree with. And honestly, this has been a major part of the discussions we've been having across AJT with our playwrights, our artistic directors, our theater mockers, even on our social media. For instance, we have this weekly discussion that occurs on Thursdays on Twitter. It's called Weekly Kvetch. And we've had several iterations of the questions, who gets to write Jewish stories and who gets to play Jewish characters? People have come from all sorts of perspectives and experiences in answering this constantly changing and evolving question. Also, recently, I read a piece by an AJT theatermacher, Alex Rosenfeld, who was the production dramaturg on a multiracial cast production of The Diary of Anne Frank at People's Lights Theater in Philadelphia. So Alex wrote about coming from a really conflicting place when she joined this project. She was worried about a possibly harmful process and negative reception by the audience. But ultimately, her and the team got to work in sharing ancestral stories, 60-page actor packets, historical and contextual visits to museums and other organizations. And there were always responsibilities and care taken to honor, respect, and celebrate the stories of Jewish people and of Anne Frank in particular. I really think they found community there. So yeah, I hear what you're saying. It makes a lot of sense. It's a question I still personally struggle with a lot too, in terms of what it means to have casting an identity, like in what cases it's inappropriate, in what cases it's appropriate.
Mm-hmm. Like I said, I think it's something that is, that we're just working through, and like, we should stop trying to be like, okay, these are the rules and here's what we're going to do. Right. Like, it's just like, okay, let's just take it case by case and make sure everyone has a voice in the conversation. And I think the larger thing, which you brought up, is that like, when you're looking through a lens, which is not your own, you often can see your own life better, right? Like that there's, in the example that I gave of the whipping man, which has a Seder, right, which is a traditional meal that is dealing with the Jews' emancipation from slavery or enhanced freedom in that moment, at the time in which the slaves in this country were also being given this. And to see those parallels, I understood something about my own Judaism in a way that felt more real to me, because the history of slavery in this country is something that is much more palpable and much more real to me than thinking about Jews in Egypt. Like, that feels so long ago and I don't really understand. And I have not experienced that in my lifetime and in quite the same way. It's not part of my conversation the same way. So I suddenly looked at that conversation so differently and have looked at every single Seder that I've participated in since differently. You know, it has a different and much more global resonance for me. You know, when we say like, well, we're not free until everyone is free, like how much I believe that, and that is like the most, so much of it's really, and it's in there, right? But about how much, so much of the Seder is about acknowledging our privilege. And it's a really beautiful, beautiful ceremony in that way. And that was something that was given to me through a story that is both my own and not my own. And I like feel really grateful for that, even as not only as a maker, but as an audience member of that story.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's so beautiful. Thank you for sharing that.
Mm-hmm.
It's so interesting to think about. I like how you said that this is a constantly evolving conversation. This is something we constantly need to be asking of every single production, every single play, every single endeavor that we take on. Because there are so many questions and so many what ifs surrounding inclusivity and authenticity and what that means to each production we put on, which is going to bring me to my next question after we come back from our break.
All right. Okay, great.
So we're going to take a short break with a little message from our sponsors.
Thanks for listening to Theater Schmooze from Alliance for Jewish Theater. I'm Jeremy Aluma, the executive director. We have several events lined up for the rest of April 2021 that we'd love for you to attend. On Tuesday, April 27th at 5 p.m. Eastern, we're hosting a Holocaust theater panel with Holocaust survivors, playwrights, and historians. On Thursday, April 22nd at 3 p.m. Eastern, we have a playwright community conversation where playwrights will meet with one another to discuss strategies, ideas, and solutions. And on Thursday, April 29th at 3 p.m. Eastern, we have an artistic director community conversation. To learn more about these programs, email me at jeremy@alljewishtheater.org and check out our website, alljewishtheater.org. Thank you and enjoy the rest of Theater Schmooze Episode 2.
All right, everyone. Welcome back to our interview with Kimberly Senior. So just before our break, we were talking about a couple of different things. Collaboration, Jewish identity, what it means to constantly be amenable in terms of the different conversations around identity and what is acceptable, what's not acceptable, how to be the most anti-racist, the most progressive, the most inclusive, how that's constantly evolving and it's like a living page. To me, that brings me back to your roots in Chicago theaters, your DIY approaches and ensemble collectives. As somebody that's actively part of that community right now, I just hear so much of that similar and really encouraging rhetoric in the community. So I wanted to talk to you a little bit about your experiences with Steppenwolf, Collaboration, Straw Dog, Timeline, Writers Theater, who also differ in terms of their own statuses in the Chicago theater community. My first question to you is, in working with these theaters, what did it look like for you to work about plays about people who are othered in the United States?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I don't know that I ever thought about it that way. Like, I think in retrospect, I'm like, well, yeah, I guess that's what I've been doing. And that for me, I was like, this is a great play. This play asks great questions. Look at the human beings in this play. This play is so well written. Like, I think I've always been driven to plays that have like a howl or a cry or like a trauma at the center of them. Cause I believe that, I mean, look, I do a lot of comedies too, which is not to say those things are not at the heart of comedies as well, but that there's something when there's this active thing that's underneath the play, the act of making the play and working on the play becomes steps towards healing. The act of like sharing that play with an audience, like maybe together we can heal if we witness these stories together. If we see this conflict play out, like maybe these are steps towards our healing. And so I think I've more been drawn to that than like consciously knowing I was doing something about representation. Like I think it was a more subconscious desire to put stories on our stages that were going to get us talking. I have not ever been really interested, and this I can say from my place of privilege because I have been represented in books and in films and on stages, like what I look like and who I am. So I can say like I'm not really interested in seeing that because I know what it is to be me. I don't need to watch somebody else act like me. You know, that's very not interesting to me. I want to see, you know, I fell in love with stories by like reading, in particular, I'm a huge reader, and like from reading books about people who are not like me from other times, from other parts of the world, of different experiences. And then to like, I just remember being like a little girl and like reading a story about a little girl who lived in Russia, who also like fought with her mom. And I was like, we're not that different. Like, I loved that. And then I also loved being like, what's that food she's eating? I don't know what that is. Like, so both the like curiosity and discovery of other cultures through human stories, but also being able to find our kind of like humanity. So like, that's always what I've been drawn to. And I know that it's easy for me to say that because I can say like, well, I don't need to watch a Neil Simon play. Like I like live one. So why should I watch one? No shade on Neil Simon. Right. But like maybe there's like a family in Indonesia that like is like, we don't know any Neil Simon. Like that story there is really exciting.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a really good point. And I think a lot of people in the DIY theater community in Chicago aren't necessarily looking out for those stories, but those are the ones that are interesting to us. Like you said, it's about learning about a perspective other than yours, about finding connection with it, but also finding surprise within it.
Well, you know, and this is, you know, I'm going to say when you're talking about Chicago theater in that way, or you're talking about a DIY community, regardless of their urban center, that like up until now, it seems like that sort of storefront theater has had to do the heavy lifting of getting those stories out there, of centering those stories, because perhaps some of the larger theaters were not centering those stories, or if they were, they were on their second stages or in their smaller spaces. Mm-hmm. And so I would love for some of our, you know, smaller storefronts who are duct taping it all together, for them to get to do a big blockbuster hit, you know, and have access to that, because it's not that they don't want to do them. It's that they're getting denied those rights a lot of times. And then to also like, so that really that the stories go where they belong. You know, I've had to put plays that are big epic plays in really small spaces. And I've been given the privilege of putting smaller plays that don't even really need that big of a canvas on really big stages.
Yeah.
And so I think there's something about like, why don't we put stories where they belong first, rather than just like, and that this is a hard statement for me to say, because, and especially for those of you who are listening who are not from the Chicagoland theater, like this, what needs to be explained about it is that like non-equity doesn't equal non-professional in Chicago, that you can see work of such excellence in some of our smaller spaces as you can. They're not like stepping stones necessarily on the way to something bigger. There are financial differences, both in terms of like how people get paid and what those resources are, but the work is excellent everywhere. And it is something that I have a great pride in and like can't wait to like come back and make a play, you know, above a restaurant with a pole in the middle of the theater. I think like there is like no greater joy than trying to figure that out and having navigated spaces where 25 people saw a play at a time and also like, you know, 1500 people saw a play at a time. The work is the same. The love is the same. You know, the like pride in the work is the same. The energy is the same, right? The paycheck is different. What tools you have at your disposal are different. And it's hard for me to say like, oh, these stories of representation or these stories that are bringing something that has maybe been marginalized to life, like has been shoved to the fringes. They've also gotten really, really great, great, great voice in those stages. And oftentimes I think people look to Chicago smaller stages, that's the work that then like travels all over the country in a really cool way, which is the story of Disgraced, which premiered at the May It Rest in Peace American Theater Company. You know, the first audience that saw that play was 99 people. And yeah. I'm like incredibly proud of that and that's where that story grew from. So I just want to make sure for the non-Chicago insider listening, like, and for the Chicago people to say like, hey, you're doing the great work. And I would, you know, it's not a burden to tell these stories, but I hope that these stories can be more represented across all different size theaters.
Yeah. Yeah. And thank you so much for touching on that. I think that is a really important point to bring up, that Chicago is, I don't want to say privileged in that way. I feel privileged to be in this city and in this community to constantly experience really excellent, really thought-provoking, really beautifully and masterfully done theater, regardless of what kind of venue it's in, whether it's in a found space, whether it's in a park, whether it's on a big stage that everybody knows the name of. I've seen truly incredible performances on every single, like on the same exact level at all those places. One thing I did want to touch on, I think it's going to be our last question of the day, is the idea that we need to be bringing more of these stories to the bigger stages. We need to be engaging more widely distributed audiences with stories that often don't get told. What are the systems in place, in your opinion, that need to start changing and adapting and listening in order for that to happen?
I'm going to start with something that I think is very positive, which is about this pandemic. And actually what we are doing right now is audio, and Audible Theater is an entire theater division where they do, when we can, plays in person at the Minnelli Theater in Residence. But then those shows like Bella Bella and a play called Sakina's Restaurant with Asif Manvi, that then they are available, that there's so much more access that is being made possible through audio. And I'm really excited. And I think it's a very new field and we don't know its potential yet. And that access is so thrilling to me. Something that's relatively affordable to make, that anyone, anywhere they are, as long as they can, like, they have the technology to, will have access to so many more stories. So that is something that we are only beginning to, like, unleash the potential of, and I can't wait to see where that goes and what those stories are. But it definitely feels like anyone can play. It feels like a very fair playing field, and I'm excited about that. So that's my positive thing. Again, I think the theme of this is like there is no rule book, right? There's no quick fix and there's no answer. And trying to find quick fixes and checking off lists is part of what got us to where we are today. I think the problem needs to not be solved at the college level, but at the kindergarten one. Mm. And I think there are immediate changes that can be made, obviously. I think, you know, one look no further than the We See You White American Theater demands. I think there are a lot of wonderful immediate things that can be done that are not difficult, that are not expensive, that can like happen right away. But I think that there's a larger thing about who are we empowering to tell their stories? And that's like, I'm talking about 3- and 4-year-olds and what are we putting into the zeitgeist of being an American in this moment? And there's a cultural and a fabric change that needs to happen so that there are just that many more stories and that many more artists to tell them. How are we providing access and opportunity, especially in theater? Theater has been a place for the privileged. Like, it doesn't pay well. So you like have to have a way to like have some money or work 14 jobs to be able to do that. And if you are working 14 jobs, like, you know, yeah, I worked 14 jobs while I was like coming up, sure. But I also had a car, which is privilege. So like I had a way to get from my job to job to job to do that, right? So that there's a sense of even like, you know, if you're a kid whose parents are doing everything they can and they're working a million jobs, they're not going to raise you to like go be a theater artist where you're not going to make any money. You know, like the logic that's coming from that household is like, we really hope you're going to be in a lucrative field, like that we're doing this for you so that like you will be set up for success. So how are we rethinking the economic model of how theater is working? How are we making it a place where no matter where you come from, you can participate in this field? So I think a lot of like the answers to this, I think one of the biggest shifts and something that probably easier said than done for me sitting here in my bedroom gym office to say that like theaters talk a lot about values, and all the theaters where I work, I'm very proud of their values and what they say their values are. But the real like hard truth is that like I think values actually live in like budget lines. Mm-hmm. And I think until we see those values actually played out, not just in declaration, but in action, we will continue to have problems. And so I look forward to finding the right way for me to be part of the solution, whether it's like in mentorship or in reading 7,000 plays so that we can find all those stories, or, you know, however I can be helpful. I feel very optimistic about what I've been calling the level up. Like we're not going back, we're leveling up. So I hope in the level up that we start taking steps towards like all of this inclusivity and parity. And I'm just excited to see what happens. And I know that it's like not my mind alone that needs to solve this problem. You know, and in fact, I should probably just like be quiet and sit back for a minute and figure out what's happening.
Well, I personally really appreciate your voice and perspective here.
Thank you.
To your point from earlier, the pandemic has opened up a lot of venues of storytelling, but also exposed a lot of what some people saw as very apparent and other people just didn't pay attention to, issues in the entertainment industry and in the theater industry, the closing of theaters around the country, the fact that so many troops have just fallen apart during this pandemic. Mm-hmm. And I'm hoping that afterward that we find our way back, but I also hope we find our way back to something that is more sustainable. So
yeah, I've like talked about this time too in many different ways. Obviously, we've all found many different ways to talk about this time. But one thing I've thought a lot about is like I've thought of this. I've sort of all gone between that one could title this period of time as preparation. Like we all this time to prepare, like, and there's going to be something that comes out of this. Like I'm not even sure what we're preparing for, but I think that there's like a lot of amazing artists out there that like are really excited to unleash something on us. And I can't wait to see what those things are. But I've also thought about it as like fortress building. Like we're all sort of fortifying and strengthening so that we're like, we know our home, we know our center, and like we are now like ready to like go from there. So I hope that's true.
Yeah, I think it is true.
Yeah. We'll see. Like, yeah. Let's time capsule this moment. Talk to you a year from today. Yeah.
Exactly. Yes. Thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome, Danielle. It's so fun.
I agree. And I want to thank you, listeners, for tuning in today to Theater Schmooze. A special thanks to Danny Debner and Lawrence Goodman, our producers, Ilya Levinson and Alex Kaufman, the composers of our theme music, Jeremy Aluma, the executive director of Alliance for Jewish Theater, and the entire Alliance for Jewish Theater community. If you like what you've heard today, support this podcast and all our initiatives towards connecting Jewish theater makers by making a tax-deductible donation to Alliance for Jewish Theater at alljewishtheater.org or joining as a member. Make sure to give us a review on iTunes and follow Alliance for Jewish Theater on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram to learn more about upcoming Jewish theater events, group meeting, and news in our world. I'm Danielle Levski, and I'll see you next time. L'chaim.